From all corners of the globe to your ears, it's the Midnight Movie Cowboys. Sometimes informative, sometimes controversial, but always unpredictable. It's the Midnight Movie Cowboys podcast with your hosts, Hunter, John, and Stu. And now, on with the show.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Midnight Movie Cowboys. I am Hunter, and joining me in the Rocky Mountain High is Mr. John Grace. Say hello, John.
Hello.
And in from the album cover of Destroyer, we have Stuart Balk. Say hello, Stu.
Hello. See, this burnt-out city represents Melbourne, so...
Ah.
Ooh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. And coming up to us from the void of hell... of ex nihilo, we have Eric Zaldivar, who is the blank space on the screen. Say hi, Eric.
Sorry, no video this week.
Well, is the Hotel Cecil gone?
Yeah, I guess
that was obliterated in the Kyle Rittenhouse riots.
Yeah.
forthcoming.
And joining us, we have a guest this week, Chris Pajali. Say hello, Chris.
Hello, I'm in New Rochelle, New York.
So we have a interesting topic to get into, but first let's do the whip out our junk segment. All right. So who wants to go first?
John went first last time, so we'll make it that way.
All right.
John? Okay. Yeah, sure. Let's see if you can see this. It's the Meters box set. It's pretty much everything they recorded and released, except for I think a few 45 rarities that you have to buy like one extra CD for. But the Meters were, of course, the great New Orleans funk R&B band of late 60s and the 70s. This is everything. This is their independent label stuff, their major label stuff. It's basically the New Orleans group that the Beastie Boys are trying very hard to imitate when they do instrumental tracks on their later records.
I know the Red Hot Chili Peppers covered some of their songs.
Oh, yeah.
And yeah,
not with a tenth of the talent.
No.
Yeah,
Primus also.
Oh,
yeah, I think that's true.
I think Primus did Tippy Toes on one of their. I think there's an EP with some covers on it, and they did Tippy Toes on that.
Yeah, well, Primus sucks. That's what you say when you're a Primus fan.
I saw the Meters in concert about 10 years ago.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, really good.
Yeah,
really good concert. Good show.
Just fantastic.
They put the drummer up front.
Oh, cool.
Ziggy Modalisti was up front, and they had him behind these clear soundproof, you know, so it wouldn't bleed, so the drumming wouldn't bleed into the microphones.
Right.
Yeah. So he was up front rather than me. Usually the drummer's in the back. But
I wonder if Don Henley stole that idea.
Yeah. He's so interesting. It's an interesting drummer to watch. So that's why they put him up front.
Yeah. That's all I can say is you get a Meters set, you get a bunch of their albums. That's music. That's playing right there. Those guys are highly skilled.
Yeah. Cool. All right. You got anything else, John?
Nope. That's it. I was hoping to have the Joseph Quo box set, but maybe next week. They told me they mailed it. Wait.
Stu, what about you? What do you got? Whip it out.
No, you do, because I'll be back in a second.
Oh, all right. Well, my stuff this week is super redundant. I got 88 Films Chinese Boxer.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, John had that last week. John also had New York Ninja last week.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so
our guest is on that. He's on the documentary.
You hear that, Vinegar Cinnamon? 88 Films, you're selling copies already with this segment. Selling copies. Yeah. Okay, now these two things used gets, but pretty cool. This one, when I saw this one on the shelf at the used bookstore, I had to snap it right up. John, we've done a show on one of these.
Okay,
Houdini the movie star.
Oh, you found it.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. Damn.
Yeah, this thing goes for a pretty penny on the internet. But it's got the Master Mystery, Terror Island, The Man from Beyond, which we covered.
Oh, man.
Haldane of the Secret Service. So, yeah.
Which one's the one with the robots?
That is the Master Mystery.
Okay.
So
I keep wishing they'd reissue that on blue at least. And
I know
they haven't even bothered.
Most people have no clue that Houdini was in movies. They don't like, it's kind of a lost chapter of history. I don't know. I was fascinated with Houdini when I was a kid.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Maybe kids today probably don't care, but whatever.
Maybe
I don't care, they don't care about anything.
What?
Maybe because these films have disappeared.
His movie career did a vanishing act. Yeah.
Death does that, you know.
Yeah. And I found this Walt Disney on the Front Lines.
One of their
steelbook things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, I was kind of doing some Disney stuff in my film class this year. Because, you know, the brand, it perks up. But when you go into the history of it, there's a lot of fascinating stuff. And so I thought this would be cool for my class. So I snapped it up.
Oh, very neat.
You just wanted that steelbook shelf to grow further, didn't you?
Yeah.
Mr. Steelbook Shelf.
Mr. Steelbook Shelf. So yeah, that's
my many identities, Mr. Hunter.
So that's it for me.
All right. Well, but I got a parcel sent to me from the NES. Couple of them.
Uh-oh.
There's a whole bunch of stuff in there. I won't showcase them all. I'll just do a couple. The rest I'll do next week. The first one is NES sent me. Oh, I've got to turn my background off. Forgot about that.
Oh yeah, that doesn't work.
Where did Ace Frehley go?
Don't work. It's just gonna be Gene laughing everywhere.
Where did Ace Frehley go? That's what I want to know.
He's been cut out to put me in there.
I got you.
He's too drunk. So they oh fucking hell. I gotta work this out again. Shit. Me choose virtual background. Sorry, people. None. Right, there we go.
There we go.
All right.
So the first one Nez sent me, and he's obviously done because he heard us talk about it, was National Lampoon's Movie Madness.
Oh! Drink some coffee, Stu.
Either that, yeah. I've just read universally across the board that it's awful. Absolutely unwatchable, but I will watch it.
You have no idea. You have no idea how bad that is.
Anthony says, well, you guys, it's just because it's unwatchable. It's terrible.
And it's still missing that segment, that one segment that was cut years ago. Yeah. They didn't restore it.
Yeah.
Could have at least done that.
We spoke about it, didn't we? Which one it was?
Yeah, for the bad movie freaks.
That's right. This one may be a future show if you guys own it. If not, I can get it to you. He sent me Love and Money.
Oh, wow.
You know who did that?
James Toback.
Toback, yeah.
Yeah.
That's I had no idea.
That's the movie that Warren Beatty got Pauline Kael to produce on, basically to, you know, they pulled a Harry Knowles on her, like, where they were like, they kind of played to her ego to bring her in and then sort of shoved her nose in some cow poop, you know?
So, oh, really?
Yeah.
Anyway, I had no idea what it was. So I looked at the back and it said written, produced, and directed by James Toback. And I knew exactly why Anthony sent it along.
Did it come with a smelly folded up IMDb?
It does. It's actually, it was in there in the sleep. I took it out because I'm going to start waving around as well in the city when I go to work. It worked for him. It may work for me. All right, getting down to the last three. John, you will like this one. The complete Blue Sky recordings of Derringer. 76 to 78. Rick Derringer's band, just named Derringer. But they got the three studio albums, the two live albums. Fucking hard rock classics, these things are. Gotta check them out. Yeah, there's that. Keep it on Rick Derringer. Another one. This is live. Radio broadcast February 18, 1977 from the Whiskey A Go-Go. This album burns. If you can find it, I couldn't get it here. I had to get Anthony to send it to me from the UK. If you can find this album rips. It is so good. Recommended. Last one. Wait, this thing's a monster.
It's a wrestling album. Rick Derringer. Guitar.
Derringer is one of the most underrated hard rock bands of the 70s. They are just awesome. Last one. This will be the put your hands down, Stuart. This will be the whip at your junk of the year. I defy anybody to get something better than this. All right, I'm calling it now. When I was on my hiatus back earlier in the year, and I did a studio's view, I did one on Studio 54. And I mentioned how they had a particular item out that I really, really wanted. Well, Nez said to me, got a present for you in the mail coming your way for your 50th. Because this Saturday or Friday this week, I turned 50. So it's my birthday. So he goes, I got a present for you in the mail. And he sent me this, the Studio 54 book.
Oh, wow.
This thing is a monster. It weighs, I think it weighs, you know, 3.5 kilos. Or what is that? 9 pounds or something like that. And it's a beast. Oh, I can't. Yeah, it's just fucking, it is unreal. I've gone through it briefly. It's just, Anthony, I'm stunned. I really had no idea. This thing goes over $100 retail. Yeah.
Wow.
It's not so much a coffee table book as it is a coffee table itself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is an absolute beast.
Does it have like a coaster built into the
pitch?
Like Kramer's coffee table book about coffee tables.
The only problem is the embossing on this thing. It comes away a little bit. That's not Anthony's fault. It's just the way they've done it, which I read reviews, which it does. It is a common thing, but I don't care. It gives that sort of worn-in look. But that's that. So, Nez, I cannot thank you enough. That is just unbelievable. I am just stunned. Absolutely stunned and in love with it. So that is it for me for this week.
Fantastic. Good.
I will have more next week. There are other things on the way and the rest of the stuff Anthony sent me, but that's it. So
sweet. All right. Well, let's jump into our topic. So
did Chris have something? Or did we
Yeah, that's right. I'm sorry.
This is self-promotion here, but I got these came out last month, two Kino Lorber Blu-rays that I'm on the audio commentaries. I elbowed my way into Kino Lorber, which they seem to only have about 8 people that do all of their commentaries.
Yeah, it's Alex Cox needs to do all of the commentaries. Yeah. We need to hear from him on everything.
I missed them. What are the titles?
Okay, well, Golden Needles. Okay. Which, the Weintraub Heller production, right after Enter the Dragon and Black Belt Jones, they did this with Joe Don Baker, Elizabeth Ashley, and Lalo Schifrin did the score. So they were trying to recapture some of the magic of Enter the Dragon and not doing that.
You got to sell the movie, Chris.
it's a fun movie.
It's a gem.
It's a fun movie without having too much of the martial arts action, which they were advertising it as, and also, I mean, when it didn't work out that way, they were really pushing the Joe Don Baker aspect of it. But it's fun, and it was written by Esli Pogostin, who had done a movie a few years before called Hard Contract, which I really like a lot, the James Coburn, which was Harlan Ellison's favorite movie of 1969. nobody went to see it. It was not a hit, Hard Contract, and Golden Needles was not a hit either. And then the other one I did was Masquerade, which I only did because I had never seen it. And so I was looking forward to seeing that. And that's another, the way it was advertised, they were trying to make it look like another charade.
Right.
Yeah, because charade had been such a big hit that like everybody was trying to do. It was usually Universal trying to recapture.
So you did an audio commentary for that one, is that right?
But yeah, with Howard S. Berger on both of these.
But you've not seen it, but you've done an audio commentary.
Right. Yeah.
Well, you're a genius.
Well, I did some research beforehand. Well, no, they sent me the a link so I could watch the movie first. And,
oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah, and then we recorded the commentary on Zoom like a week later. So I got to watch it first, and yeah. So both of those are out now, and then something that I had nothing to do with, which arrived in the mail recently, is the Yokai Monsters.
Oh, I want to get that.
Yeah, I want that too.
So I'm looking forward to diving into that.
What I want to do is have never seen a movie or know anything about it, convince a company to let me do the commentary, and then do the commentary the first time I'm seeing it. Right. Just go, wow, this is pretty cool.
Hey. That's how it is for a lot of actors and directors sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Dude, there are some commentary tracks with directors where they just kind of sit there and go, that was a good scene.
Yeah.
Yeah, Snatch by Guy Ritchie. That was one of the worst I've ever heard.
Arnold is the funniest.
Have you heard James Caan do a Get Smart, his Get Smart episode?
Oh, no.
Like James Caan? Yeah, he's the villain on a Get...
End of commentary?
No, he just sits there, he's just laughing at it. He goes, this is so funny. He's just cracking up. He hasn't seen it in decades. Like,
that's...
I used to watch Get Smart all the time. I told Don I wanted to be on the show, and he's just laughing at everything.
I used to watch it with the girls at the Playboy Mansion.
Yeah, exactly. Like, oh, look, Pat McCormick's so funny here. Pat's doing some routine where he's having trouble shutting a door. He's like, he's just cracking up. It's just James Caan laughing for like 20 minutes.
You know who... One of the commentary styles that I find really irritating, and William Friedkin is guilty of this, is I'm describing the movie you're watching.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And so this is the scene where Father Merrin first encounters Pazuzu in Egypt. It's a very powerful scene. We see Merrin staring at the statue, which is the avatar of Pazuzu. Yes, I know, but, William. But I am Hunter, watching the movie. Thank you.
He was a visionary because from his commentary style onwards, they created the audio descriptive language.
Yeah. Yeah. He was really helping out disabled folks.
He was.
He wanted to make sure the blind could watch The Exorcist.
Hurricane Bill's better when he's talking about other movies.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he's great in other aspects, but when he's talking about his own films, Yeah.
Where's that commentary for Sorcerer gone? Freaking.
Does he still hate it? Or has he come around?
I don't know.
I thought he came around. I thought he came around to it.
Yeah. Can't imagine.
Oh, no, he did because he actually, I'm sorry. I saw Sorcerer in 2002 for the 25th anniversary and he was in the audience.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think I remember you saying you saw it.
Just remember that. Yeah. He was there. And he actually, he spoke quite fondly of it. So he's come around, but.
Okay.
It just took forever.
Right. Well, you know, in the short term, it must suck when you work really hard on a film like that. It's great. And then it just doesn't, it just kind of turns out not to be a good thing for your career.
Didn't he say that Sorcerer was his best film? He found it to be his best film?
Well, maybe. He actually says that his favorite film is Jade, which I think he's trolling, but I don't know.
Yeah. Oh, he doesn't think that. Oh, man. Oof. So I still
don't know why he fired James Ellroy from a project he never made. Like Ellroy's never told me what happened. He just said that's the most egomaniacal man I've ever worked with.
Oh, I believe that. So let's go on to our topic.
Hey, what about me?
Yeah.
Eric.
Oh yeah. Yeah, Eric's got to describe something.
You want to describe? Yeah. Do it like a William Friedkin commentary track.
So I got two arrows. I can't even do it. Unless I'm talking about William Friedkin's career, I cannot do William Friedkin.
You have to kind of embellish what you say.
Lucio Fulci was a great influence on my films. He did I saw an interview with him one time where he had some edgy opinion about the Klan. It's like what people, because he was talking about Birth of a Nation, what people don't remember is that, what did he say? You gotta remember that there was a lot of black crime during the Reconstruction. Anyways,
was he listening to Amarin or something?
I don't know. But speaking of the KKK, my purchase was Django, the Arrow. Mm. The Arrow version? Yeah. I own like three or four copies of the movie. This is the last time I'm going to be purchasing it ever again.
Yeah, no. I said that about Psycho back about 10 years ago.
No, that's it. That's it for me. It kind of hurt me. It was on clearance at 50% or at Barnes & Noble's because I was there for another movie, which I'll talk about in a second. But we got, I mean, this is old. This is like a four-year-old disc, right? So whatever, you got the usual suspects. You got Franco in there. You got Noriko Bucci. Okay, she talks about the movie. Got a guy named Austin Fisher. I don't know who that is. And then you got Alex Cox, An Introduction to Django. So, you know.
There it is.
It's great to, to shoehorn the proletariat every time. So
yeah,
that's good.
The commies from Mars got to come and weigh in.
Yeah. They could have called me and I had some crazy stories that Franco refuses to tell. But, you know, I'm not bitter. That's fine. We're moving on. We got High Sierra. I bought the Criterion.
I got that. Yeah.
I'm not surprised. I mostly got it for Colorado Territory, the Western remake. Comes with it.
Cool.
And then finally I did get for pretty cheap the Sartana box set.
Oh, very nice.
Yes. Cool. Also filled with questionable material, but that's okay. There's some good stuff in there too.
Yeah.
Eric, have you got this Sabata box set yet?
That is a German box set, right? I bought a Sabata box set way back in 2005, the MGM one that was gold.
No, I do plan
on getting the Blu-ray at some point. It's German, right? Isn't it?
I don't know. I think it's out by Eureka. I think they put it out like the Joseph Coy set.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I think Eureka did put it out.
Huh. Yeah, I'm going to have to go and get that because, the 2005 gold edition does not hold up at all.
Okay.
Neither do those movies. And anyway.
Well, you could say that too. But Paolino's the genius, so I give him some slack.
They've all got one thing in common. They're all on home video, unlike this film we're talking about tonight.
That's right.
Oh, gosh.
That's right. So last week, I think, this movie called The Farmer popped up on YouTube. It's from 1977. I've never heard of it, but Mike Malloy posted about it, directed by David Berlatsky. And it's kind of it's a movie that's never really gotten a home video release, or I don't know. But this, I started noticing all these posts on Letterboxd about it. The response to Mike's thread was big. And y'all were wanting to do a show on it. So, Chris, I'm going to hand it over to you. What's the big deal with the farmer?
the farmer has just been it's been out of circulation for so long that this real sort of cult following has emerged just about the movie and its connection with Code Red and with the Olsen brothers and the wrestler that they're running that company with now, the whatever his name is, and their posts, and you know they've had or they've claimed to have the home video rights to this for 12 years, something like that. They keep promising that they're going to put it out or that it's on the horizon, and so they've sort of built it up in reputation for the last 12, 14 years. I forgot how long, because we were talking about it on Facebook, right? Like somebody went back and looked at the posts, and I think it goes back to like 2006.
Yeah, Lost Media Wiki said 2006 was the first notation when they mentioned having it or having a print, and then they would put that trailer on almost every Code Red action release as this like a tease for like more than a decade. So it's been like 15 years, I guess.
Yeah, 15 years.
Which is crazy.
And, you know, I remembered I went to a Chiller Theater convention, and it was at least 15 years ago. It was maybe, yeah. And Gary Conway was a guest there. And I came back, and then on the Saturday, I went out to Jersey, attended the show. I saw Gary Conway there, but I didn't talk to him. And then the next day, someone posted on one of the message boards that he had brought a copy of it and shown it like at midnight. I don't know if it was a 16 print or something, but yeah. And that it had been unannounced. He just showed up. Cause at the time at these conventions, they would show 16 prints during, in a ballroom or something, like all during the show. Like Cinema Wasteland did that a couple times I was there. Like they were running like Empire of the Ants and some other things. Like people would bring 16 millimeter prints to show. I remember I saw Combat Shock, the director's cut of Combat Shock on 16 at a Fangoria convention, in like 1990 or 91. So I don't know if they still do that, but that was what happened at this one Chiller convention, and I was really irritated because I had missed The Farmer. So that was one missed opportunity. And then a friend of mine, John Charles, who used to, he was one of the editors of Video Watchdog for a long time. He had seen it on television, and I think he'd even taped it off TV, but then erased it. So I knew it had played on television, and I knew about the movie because I had a poster of it under the title Blazing Revenge. And in like the mid 80s, when I started collecting movie posters, there was a dealer that I would buy posters from in Canada named Shelley Wallach. And she would send out monthly updates of the poster. So I would get these little letters in the mail. Sometimes it was just like a little tiny sheet of paper with like five titles. This is what I got this month. And there would be five movies. And so I got one of these updates, and there was a movie, Blazing Revenge, and there was no information about it at all. And she would have different pricing for the posters. So it'd be like $5, $10, $15. And this was like a $5 poster. And I think I had credit. So I said, you know what? I've never heard of this thing. Why'd you just send me Blazing Revenge? So the poster came a couple weeks later, and I was like, oh, it's The Farmer. It's great. So that mystery was solved. It was just one of these movies I always heard about and would come across in like posters, poster sales or going through microfilm, or, like looking at old movie reviews and seeing The Farmer. Cause I mean, it got a major studio release. It was released by Columbia, but it was, I couldn't find it anywhere. It was never put out on video. It apparently played TV, but not in my area. And nobody had a bootleg of it during, when the gray market tapes, in the late 80s and through the 90s, when things that weren't legally available on video, like the Candy Snatchers or Darker Than Amber, or things like that, that, maybe were put out overseas and then were bootlegged and distributed here.
Some of the stuff.
Yeah. It just never showed up in the usual channels, until last week.
I gotta be honest. When I started watching this, I thought, oh, this is like a joke. Like Blair Witch Project, like a found footage film. I didn't think it was real.
It was such bad quality. I don't know where that came from. If it was something, shot off a wall. I mean, it seemed to be like there were breaks sometimes in the recording. Like somebody had paused it,
Yeah,
so like commercials, maybe, maybe, or something.
Yeah, I think one story out there was like a U-matic tape or something. Or
oh,
I can't imagine this is the version that played TV because it was super graphic.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, it was. This made my eyes bleed watching it. It was, you know, it's tough to look at.
It brought me back 15 years ago. It was probably the last time I had to see something like that.
Yeah,
I got a question about American. What do you call it? The ratings board. If who's the company who got the rights to this? Supposedly Code Red.
Yeah,
right.
If they were to put this out, would they face blowback from the MPAA, or could it go out unrated? Whatever unrated means. I don't know how it works over.
They could just release it. I don't think there'd be.
They could. Blowback. Okay.
Yeah. Well, it was rated R, but I think it had to be cut to get the R rating. I think they were told to cut it ahead of getting an X rating. Like there was nothing reported in the trades about it getting an X rating. I think they were just probably warned beforehand about it. Like you'll need to cut this, or we're going to give it an X rating. And also it was submitted by a studio. So I think if it had been an independent, they would have just nailed them, you know, because they apparently just didn't like independence. I mean, that's what I always hear. Whereas for a major studio, maybe they just warned them ahead of time so they wouldn't have the stigma. You know, I mean, 10 years later, Pray for Death, they just gave that an X. And you know, it was reported in Variety that it got an X rating. Just like Street Fighter got an X, and you know, it's, you know, deal with it. You cut it, or you know, put it out with an X, and you know, newspapers won't advertise it in some cities, and so on and so forth. Certain theater chains won't run it. 1974, some theater chains would run an X-rated movie like the Street Fighter because it's just violence. They would say, oh, well, it's an X rating for violence. So a chain like Lowe's, which had a lot of inner city theaters that would run the Kung Fu movies. And, you know, I don't think they cared, but other chains would have a bigger problem with that, with an X rating. And again, some cities wouldn't run newspaper advertising or TV advertising for an X rated movie, no matter what the reason for the rating. I think it probably, yeah, was cut before getting the X rating, and that was only because of a major studio. I forgot who, I think it was Jeff Goodhart who mentioned on Facebook about he asked how it compared to Rolling Thunder.
Yeah, it was him.
Similar movie.
Yeah, and that had, you know, different war, but same time period. And that had been at Columbia briefly. Right before, because Lawrence Gordon had purchased that script from Paul Schrader while he was at AIP. And then he left AIP like in 73, went to Columbia to do the Walter Hill movie, Hard Times.
Yeah.
Right. And I think he tried to set it up at Columbia, and then it got, with Schrader directing, and then it went to Fox. And I think it was supposed to be released by Fox, Rolling Thunder, but they had some disastrous previews, and Fox, you know, wanted it cut, and they didn't want to, Lawrence Gordon and John Flynn didn't want to cut it, so it went back to AIP. But it was at Columbia briefly, and also Taxi Driver was Columbia, and there's a connection between Taxi Driver and The Farmer, because George Memoli, who's the villain in The Farmer, was supposed to be in Taxi Driver. He was supposed to play the role of the cuckolded husband. That's
Scorsese role.
Scorsese. Right.
Yeah, he was that sick was supposed or something. To
be. Yeah, well, he got injured on the farmer, which I confirmed. I talked with Gary Conway over the summer, and I asked him about that because there's some confusion over what movie George Memmeli had been injured on, because somebody, I don't know who it was, but somebody told a story about him because he fractured his skull. So there was some brain damage that he sustained during The Farmer, but somebody told a story that it had happened on Blue Collar, and that he had said something to Richard Pryor, and Richard Pryor picked up a chair and smashed it over his head, which, I mean, yes. that could have happened also. Yeah. I don't know, but the injury, what Scorsese tells is that the injury had happened on The Farmer, and that was what contributed to Memmeli's death like a decade later, like in the mid 80s. He died from this, like this injury, which I think it had brought on dementia or something by that time. But I think it was somebody, because he was in the Ace Trucking Company, which was a comedy troupe.
Right.
With Fred Willard and Patty Deutsch and that actor, I can't remember his name right now, but he did "You Can Call Me Ray" or "You Can Call Me Jay," or, you know, he did those commercials in the 70s and early 80s.
Right.
But George Memmeli was part of that troupe. And I think it was Mike Mislov who told the story about Richard Pryor breaking a chair over his head. And that being what brought that about. But yeah, and so I asked Gary Conway about it. I said, was he injured? And Gary Conway said, yeah, he was seriously injured he didn't go into any detail about what happened, but he just kind of falls out of the movie.
Really. Yeah.
He's killed, but you don't really see it. I think he just gets shot and falls down, and there isn't really anything big, you know, considering he's the main villain.
Yeah, I thought it was odd how his character has this big scene where he dumps, you know, he blinds this guy, and you're like, oh man, we got to get this dude. And then you just see him like one more time, and he just gets killed, and that's it. You know, and
right.
I was going, what?
Well, they make it more about Timothy Scott, who's Weasel, I think, right? Because he rapes Angel Tompkins.
Yeah, he gets the big rape scene. So, you know, at the end, he gets shot in the crotch, you know? So, you know, we get the rape revenge stuff in the movie. But yeah, so John, had you seen any of this before, or?
Had never seen it before. Had I think I first read about it probably on Chris's blog. I think it's Tipple Schlock or whatever, like a missing in action film. And I had seen the trailer on the Code Red thing, and I believe I'd seen like a Gore Gazette review from the 80s when I guess it was dragged out and made part of a double bill at one of the flea pits on 42nd Street, and Rick Sullivan was raving about it. And that's really all I knew. And I figure, wow, just looks like a Mr. Majestic knockoff to me. And that was my impression watching it. It was inspired by Mr. Majestic. It's like, hey, let's make it R-rated and way more violent and, you know, grotesque and everything. But, you know, but like everybody else who watched it, it's now on, it's got pulled from YouTube, but I guess it's on Arc's other places. So it's everywhere. It's like there's no stopping it now.
What was the reason for it being pulled off of YouTube? My soul was there, a day or two, and was gone?
Code Red.
Code Red claimed to own it. They sent a cease and desist. YouTube, you can get anything pulled if you make a complaint.
Yeah.
So but people downloaded it. They threw it on Archive and Cinemageddon and all these other places. It's everywhere now. Everybody's got it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We own it, but you ain't going to see it because we're going to release it sometime.
Yeah, it's very super snipe, I think would be the word for that.
I feel like this film's not going to have an audience, really. There's going to be the people who go, oh, I remember seeing this back in 77 or the early 80s, and that's it. But to audiences who are new, I don't see it having a market.
Eric, you said you think it would do numbers.
Oh, no, just based off of the response that Mike Molloy got off of his thread. I mean, it blew up.
Yeah.
I think there's enough people out there that have been wanting to see this for 16 years, so, or 15 years, ever since the Olsens made an announcement about it. So I think, I mean, I don't know. I don't know how many units you'd have to sell in order to make a profit on that, honestly. I don't. I mean, it's hard to tell from Bill because he's always, you know, bitching about, you know, not selling any numbers. So I don't know what the magic number would be. I just think that it would not sell. I'm pretty sure there's plenty of people that want to see it. And his excuses about, well, it's already been bootlegged as of last week, so nobody's going to buy it now. It's just like, there's a major difference between seeing a third generation copy of that and, yes, and seeing a pristine copy that he supposedly has.
He's, yeah, people would, it, like, it's actually, to see it cleaned up.
It's actually the opposite. People will buy it because they got the option now of getting an HD, right, compared to saying, well, I've seen a crappy VHS transfer. I'm good. No.
Yeah.
Poor business model, that is.
Yeah. I mean, it's not in the right ratio, and it's impossible to. Yeah. Yeah.
It really is.
Yeah, they could.
I either watch this thing on the computer screen, which I do not like doing at all.
No, right? Oh my gosh, yeah. Just, watching
after a while, because I wear glasses. These glasses are my old prescription. I'll get my new ones shortly, but I was sitting going, I was like this. You know, I was going, what the fuck's going on? I can't see.
Yeah, when having to watch a movie on a device is not fun already, yeah, but when it's a movie that also looks awful,
yeah.
I'm sitting there like this.
Yeah.
And so, you know, but the plot of the film is a, like, it's like, you know, this guy, he has the Silver Star. He comes back from World War II. The bank's going to foreclose on his house. I'm a war hero. How could this happen? And he helps this dude out who's being chased by the mob. The mob blinds him and he's like, kill them for me. You killed people for the government. Why is this any different? And so he starts, and, you know, there's this girl involved, and, you know, she gets raped by the mobsters, and we get probably the most 70s love scene of all time between the farmer, man, and the woman. Like, got the music playing.
It's got the penthouse soft focus photography, yeah, like Bob Guccione shot it.
Yeah.
Vaseline on the lens. Yeah.
Surprisingly, yeah, no nudity from Angel Tompkins.
Yeah, yeah.
From what I could tell, anyway.
Well, yeah, there could have been.
Yeah.
Yeah, but how can you tell soft focus?
Yeah,
I'll tell you what, the print was so bad, his farmhand, I did not know was black until Tompkins.
I couldn't tell. I was going, what race is he?
Me, same here. I
couldn't
idea.
Tell
until she said that racial slur. I was just like, wait, what? Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I looked him up. The actor is Trinidadian.
Okay. There you go. I learned something new that I couldn't tell watching it. I was going, you know, but
I knew he was a little tan. That's,
yeah,
about it.
Yeah, I couldn't tell if it was just from working out in the sun on a farm, you know, I don't know.
Yeah. Could have been Cajun, I don't know.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. You never know. But
for a second,
so,
when I saw the credits, I saw Popwell as one of the surnames. Oh, cool. It's got Popwell. Oh, it's not Albert Popwell. It's,
yeah, and
John,
he's
Popwell,
not related either. I looked him up. He's on Facebook.
Yeah. Oh, well.
Yeah.
But it, John, as you've said in your review, most of the reviews I've seen on Facebook say the same thing. It takes a while to get started.
Yeah. The video print doesn't help. The video print does not help.
Did you feel that way, Chris?
Yeah. It does. It does take its time to get to the action part of it. Stuart, you mentioned, Popwell. I think the original writer of this had some connection to Clint Eastwood, because as an actor, because he's in some of Clint Eastwood's movies, and I think his name is George Fargo.
Oh, yeah, I know. Yeah, I know that.
Yeah,
name.
Yeah,
he entirely possible.
He did, Every Which Way But Loose, I think. I think it was associated with that.
Yeah, well, there's a James Fargo, right? Who, who worked on some, but yeah, and you know, I didn't get a chance to ask Gary Conway about this, although I did ask him about the screenplay, and so he had the script, and he wasn't happy with the original draft of it, the one that George Fargo had written. So Gary and his father rewrote the whole script. His father's John Carmody, who's credited as one of the writers. Gary Conway did not take credit, I guess, because he was already the producer and the star, and he didn't want to just add another credit to it. So he gave credit to his father, and so they rewrote the whole script. And so there are two other writers credited, and Gary Conway has no idea where they came in. He suspects it was at Columbia when the movie was sold to Columbia. He thinks that they were just added because this was independently produced and shot in Atlanta, in the Atlanta area. And obviously, you know, Gary was in the film and the producer. So he was there the whole time. He knows like what other writers were brought in. There weren't any other writers. He's like no idea who these other
people maybe it's
are.
Like the mob where they have those guys who just sign on, but they don't actually do anything and they get paid for it.
Yeah. Or like Italian movies. Don't they throw a bunch of names on to sometimes there are six or eight writers on some.
Oh yeah.
Just according to, gosh, who was, I don't remember now, but somebody said Argento had nothing to do with the writing of Once Upon a Time in the West.
Hmm.
Wouldn't shock me.
Yeah.
Like Deep Throat, that was a mafia film. It was.
Well, I think there was there's a story that goes around that Roger Corman, I think, would put his brother Gene's credit on scripts that he had nothing to do with, that he never touched, just for an extra money or whatever.
Gene? So a disagreement we had on the
Gene
lawsuit.
Gene Corman.
Oh, not Gene Simmons. Oh, okay.
A disagreement we had on the Lost low-res show film Fear City was that whether or not Nicholas St. John is a real person, the screenwriter on a large chunk of Ferreira's films. You know anything about that, Chris?
He was interviewed somewhere.
That's what we said. We thought John said he thought he saw him in like Film Comment or something.
Yeah, that's what I think I saw.
But Lores suggested that like Nick St. John is not real. He goes, "Are we sure that's a real person?"
Well, he goes back to the porn film.
Yeah, he does.
Yeah, so that's pretty early on. No, but I did read an interview with him somewhere. He definitely is low profile, and isn't he he was a screenwriting teacher at a school or something? I think I heard
maybe.
Well, I got a Nicholas St. John on Google who is says American screenwriter. However, something's wrong because born 1973. I don't think so.
It's like 3 years old when he wrote Nine Lives of a Wet Pussy. Yeah, right.
Yeah.
He's like Dean Stockwell's character on Quantum Leap.
Yeah, we lost some great jokes with Low Res talking about watching Nine Lives of a Wet Pussy, watching it while having a spaghetti dinner, and a loss of time. We'll have to get him to repeat the bit if we have him on again.
But you'd another movie where the writer was just put on was Shaft. John D.F. Black is credited as the co-writer of that. And I've seen his draft of this. He brought nothing to that script. I don't know how that got through arbitration and, with his name remaining on it, but it drove Ernest Tidyman crazy. He was pissed off about that for years that he lost residuals because of John D.F. Black getting, and it was because of the producer put him on there, and then they went off and did Trouble Man at 20th Century Fox, the producer and and John D.F. Black. But yeah, no, there was nothing in that script that, I mean, he, I don't think he even changed dialogue, which is usually what people do when they rewrite. They'll be brought in, you know, like Joss Whedon, you know, his name isn't on speed because all he did was change the dialogue, really. He just did a dialogue polish, and that's not enough to get your name on a script.
I remember Terry Gilliam burned his WGA card on film because he didn't want Alex Cox's name on Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas.
Well, I know Warren Murphy always complained that Trevanian got credit for the Iger sanctioned screenplay when it was considered unusable. And that's why Eastwood called Warren up to see if he could write a screenplay based on the book. And Warren said it cost him a lot of residuals over the years from the WGA. He was always bad about that. And it was just because Rodney Whittaker, Trevanian, had submitted the first script, but even though nothing was used, but by their rules, he had to get credit for it.
Mm-hmm.
Chris, did Conway have anything else to say about the movie besides where it was shot and screenwriting trouble?
He said that, you know, that they had rewritten the whole thing, and that the world premiere was in Detroit, and he was there for that, and it did really well in Detroit. And after that, it got a really bad review in the Detroit paper, and it was a combination of and I have a copy of this of this review. It was a combination of a bad review and an interview with Gary Conway. So they kept taking quotes from him about the violence in the movie and then being snarky about it, like a rundown of all the violent things that happened in the movie, the horrible ways that the farmer dispatches people, and then would put in a quote from Gary Conway. It was really kind of a dickish thing to do.
Make me want to see it though. I was like, oh, I gotta see that.
Yeah, right. But you know, to interview somebody who's come to town for the opening of a movie and is giving an interview to a reporter, and then, you know, the reporter then writes this negative review and just, you know, makes the filmmaker, you know, look not so great. And it's not a very nice thing to do. But yeah, he was happy with the audience reaction to the movie in Detroit. He did tell me that. And then he wanted to do a movie right after that in Atlanta. Similarly, you know, an action adventure movie that was over the top, which he wrote with his father, and they were raising money. I can't remember the guys that they went to, but they went to two actual arm wrestlers, like, you know, these professional arm wrestlers, and they had some kind of a fundraiser in Las Vegas, I believe, to get some of the production money, and it just didn't come together. But they were going to film it in 1980 in the same area, in the Atlanta area, and Conway was going to star in it as the part that Sylvester Stallone eventually played when it was made, you know, 6 years later. And I don't think he was supposed to direct it, but it was definitely, you know, it was from his script. But then when that fell apart, I believe he hired David Engelbach to rewrite the script. And then, you know, then it ended up at Cannon and other writers like Sterling Silliphant came in and rewrote it. And it became a very different movie, I guess. But it enabled Gary Conway to then do those ninja movies. And he's the villain in Ninja 2 and American Ninja 2. And he wrote the script, and he wrote the script for American Ninja 3 also. But it was because of Over the Top ending up at Cannon
he was able to leverage those other screenwriting gigs. But he came up with the idea. He was going up to see his father one day, and he passed a monster truck on his way to his father's place. And he saw a man driving, and there was a young boy next to him in the truck. And so he said, I think that's a father and son. And so he told his dad about it, and they started outlining the script and then wrote the screenplay. But they had written other things to Gary Conway had written things on his own, but he had written some other scripts with his father, including a ninja script. I was telling John about this last week. In like 1969 or 70, they wrote a script called The Power, the story of the super ninja, and had shown that around to some producers and studios in the early 70s. And I think a lot, I don't know, not a lot, but I think there are some parallels to the ninja in The Farmer, actually, because I mean, ninjas were farmers,
right? You
know, a lot of them. And so, I mean, starting with that, and also Johnny O being a gambler, and what he says in the hospital about, you know, I'm a gambler. I never got into prostitution or narcotics or anything like that. I'm just a gambler. I mean, that seemed like something that, you know, a Yakuza guy would say in a Toei movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or even like a Zatoichi film or something like that.
Right.
Like, yeah. Some character Zatoichi would help.
He's the guy who sits with his shirt off and throws dice.
plus the farmer turns out to be like the most awesome super killer in the state of Georgia, so like he's already cutting the slices of the bullets, so they'll penetrate armor or whatever. So it's like, yeah, maybe it is is a bit of the ninja script in The Farmer.
I liked him hanging out under the car, getting the dude's attention and blowing his foot off and taking, I mean, that's great stuff.
Yeah, John, you want to talk about that?
What?
John has a theory about that, where he shoots the leg and then that he topples over from the injury, and then that gets him to, you know, get shot in the chest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that was the first time I believe that this might be the earliest film where that gag appears, because it's in some of the John Woo flicks. I'm pretty sure there's characters shot in the legs and then they fall down and they get shot in the head or what have you, or the body. But that, I believe that's the first time I've seen, or that'd be the earliest usage of that stunt gag, or that, you know, that trick.
Hmm.
You know, because I guess it's stuntmen that come up with these action concepts or pieces or the gags or what have you. And it just seems like this, it's the earliest film I can think of that has that scene. Of course, I'll probably watch some old blaxploitation movie next week. It'll have the identical, just what you think you found it. Oh, wait, in this Fred Williamson movie, they did this. So.
Let's take a roundtable poll. Who reckons that Quentin Tarantino owns a print of this film?
He probably would have played it already. Somebody who might have a print, I neglected to check when I saw a list of
Garrow.
Is a guy named Harry Garrow, were you going to say?
I said Garrow probably owns a print of this somewhere.
Oh, Garrow. Well, there's another guy. There's a guy living in South Carolina or somewhere thereabouts, Harry Garrow, who owns... I don't know, really like 1,000 movie.
Did you say Harry Garrow or Harry Garrow?
Harry Garrow. It's not spelled the same, I don't believe.
Oh, like so, Harry.
Yeah.
You know, the R Garrow is already, he's Armenian. So he Harry. Is Harry. When I think, he's Harry Garrow. All right.
That's why I saw, I thought you, Eric was playing around. He said, oh, Harry Garrow.
Yeah, me too. I was going, wait.
I know, it's unfortunate that they have similar names. No, but he, a lot of the prints that play at the New Bev.
Or Harry's, yeah. No, I know Harry pretty well. He doesn't have a print of this.
He doesn't? Okay.
Nah.
He's got wild stuff. I remember seeing that list. I was like, that's insane that he has the stuff that he has.
He does, yeah. Yeah, he had... he was part of the founding of the American Genre Film Archive, because he went out to, I think it was in, he was in Missouri, and he went out to a drive-in there where there was a storage depot, or not a storage depot, but there was like a
a building on the grounds of this drive-in where they stored prints going back to the late 60s. And he didn't want to buy, I think it was like $7,000 or $8,000 the owner was asking for. And the owner said, you know, if you want them, take them now, but it's going to be, you know, X amount of dollars, but you got to get them out. You have to decide like in an hour. And Harry said, well, that's not enough time. I have to go through these prints, make sure that, you know, that's enough of them are in good shape. And no, you've got an hour. And so Harry didn't do it. So he called Tim League at the Alamo and said, you know, maybe you're interested in this. I don't have the money to take a gamble like that. So Tim actually did buy all of those prints. And that was what started the collection at the Alamo, which became the American Genre Film Archive. But Harry came across a similar deal about 5 or 6 years ago. I think it was in Nevada, or it was right on the border of California and Nevada. A film depot and like Ninja Busters was there, which had been lost for a long time, but that was part of that collection. So yeah, Harry found that and like 100 or so other prints, some other movies that had disappeared years ago. But there were a lot of kung fu prints in there and exploitation movies of all different genres. So yeah, now he does have quite a collection, but he does not have the farmer. Unfortunately. What,
did Conway say anything about the director, who was a one-time director?
I think he was a TV director. Now he didn't really say anything about.
He was an editor.
Edited
quite a lot of like Peckinpah's Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid, Kansas City Bomber, Hickey and Boggs. We brought up Walter Hill earlier.
Oh, okay.
And you could tell that he was thinking about shooting as an editor. Like that's some of the stuff towards the end in the laundromat is really well put together. Like he knew how he was going to cut the thing. Yeah, the last movie as well. He edited the last movie.
Oh man.
Yeah.
That's a movie that I think Dennis Hopper should not have taken Hodorowski's advice.
Yeah, that was a bad idea.
Cuz that is all over the that movie could have been great, I think, if it wasn't just like, let's just take everything and mix it up.
Oh, Denis, this is crap, Denis.
Denis, you want the movie to make money? This crap, this it ruins crap. This business.
You put the end at the beginning, the middle at the end, and the beginning in the middle. Come on.
That's you how have you... a naked little boy walking around throughout the whole film.
Typo. Yeah, the last movie, that's a wild, wild film. I thought Roger Spottiswood edited Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid. Let me see.
I'm going by IMDb on this one, so you know.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm looking.
It's dubious. I recently saw this that
there's a bunch of editors. One of them Spottiswood, and one of them is Burleski.
There are like three versions of that movie.
Yeah.
So probably one editor per.
I forgot Rudy Wurlitzer wrote that. He wrote Tulane Blacktop.
We just keep bringing up Alex Cox everywhere.
Yeah.
Spottiswood did Killer Elite, that right? I think he was one of the editors on that.
Or the editor.
Yeah.
And he did the remake of The Getaway. The film where
right.
Alex.
That's right. Directed it.
Right.
With Jennifer Tilly. Yeah.
But I think he had edited, or he was one of the editors on The Getaway also, maybe, I think, of the first one.
Mm. Yeah, Spottiswood's still working, man.
What was he, like 80?
Yeah, he's got to be pretty old.
Yeah.
He did a movie called A Street Cat Named Bob, and it's got a cat named Bob the Cat. So, there you go.
He's on the Blu-ray of We'll Stop the Rain. Spottiswood. I think he either does an interview or a commentary or both. I don't know. I
definitely an interview though on there.
He also directed Schwarzenegger's greatest film, The Sixth Day.
Yeah, you know what? Out of the latter four of those, that's probably the best one. Better than End of Days, better than Collateral.
Probably it's no Jingle All the Way, though.
That's true.
Yeah.
Right.
That's a tough call.
That's true. Didn't that get a sequel with Dolph Lundgren or something?
Yeah, I believe it did. Yeah. It got something.
Yep.
It's two for Dolph on Arnold sequels.
Dolph Lundgren.
Two for Dolph.
All right.
Anybody notice how spoilerific can we get here?
It's a revenge movie. You've seen one, you've seen them all. You know, you're there to watch him like get under that car and shoot the dude's foot and then shoot him in the chest. You know, I can tell you, he shoots the guy in the foot and shoots him in the chest, but it's way cooler to see it. You know.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's true. It's pretty effective seeing it.
What were you going to spoil?
Well, mostly the ending because it kind of ties into the beginning.
Yeah. I got to say, you know, we talked about how the movie takes a while to get started. The movie also takes forever to end. I mean, like with a movie like this, like the dude shoots the guy in the crotch and then it's like, that was for so-and-so and this one's for me. And he blows his head off. Awesome.
Yeah.
Like that's when I want another Shaw production to come up, like the end.
Well, which that would have been a great ending.
The end. But there's Michael Myers stuff with this assassin hunting him.
Yeah.
It's shot like Halloween, like the guy's like buying Lucky Strikes and stalking him. And then and it kind of messes up with the pacing because I'm going, where's this going? And then, you know, you get the big climax, but this guy's still hunting him. And I'm going, where's this going? Where's this going? And then, like you said, Eric, there's a little twist there. But I was going, I was getting mad. I was going, like, come on. Like, it's in. My eyes hurt.
All right. I agree that the last, it feels like forever, but it's like 2 minutes of the stalking. And, you know, you see the sniper rifle. The viewpoint is he's going to fire it. Conway and Angel Tompkins is there as well. And it goes on forever. However, the payoff is where I disagree. The payoff is really, really good.
Yeah.
It's really good because it ties into the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I don't know how much we're going to spoil here. It also, there's an interesting duality thing here going on where both of these people, the sniper, who I guess we won't reveal who it is, and Gary Conway are both veterans that come back.
Yeah.
And both get jobs as hitmen. And Gary Conway does not accept the money, but goes through with the killing. Whereas the sniper accepts the money, but does not go through with the killing.
That's a good point. That's a good point.
And also we're talking about a 70s movie. We're talking more than likely. When it was happening before we got the big reveal, I was just like, oh boy. Okay. Conway and Tompkins are going to get blown away. This is like every nihilistic, you know, ending to most of these films, you know, it's very,
very,
you know,
70s ending.
I kept going that way harder because the same thing happens there. Whereas this guy, unseen guy is, you know, following him throughout the movie. But the exact opposite happens for kind of a neat reason because at the beginning, well whatever, we won't spoil it. I like the ending quite a bit. There is, I don't know if anybody noticed because it's a blurry nightmare, but there is a title card at the end that claims it's a true story.
Yeah.
It claims it's a true story, but that the sniper ends up getting blown away like 2 months later. But of course he told
the, he lived long enough to tell the tale.
Yeah, that's right.
I like the duality though. I thought it was a nice touch and
it's a good point.
I think I like the ending as well, for the big reveal. It plays against type at the time, you know, so many countless films have these downer endings.
Yeah.
So I really enjoyed that. Somebody said earlier, I forget who, I think you brought it up, Chris, that somebody asked, how does it compare to Rolling Thunder? The answer is it doesn't. But however, there's a few pros that it has over the Rolling Thunder. You know, Rolling Thunder and Taxi Driver, which are two movies that the trailer evokes as if it's in the same tradition as, those two movies are trying to be something more than what they are. Or I think that they succeed. Taxi Driver better. Taxi Driver about loneliness and a big city, and Rolling Thunder, and how we're treating our veterans and things like that. This is just an exploitation movie.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it has very much underlying anything, except maybe it's very American in that the farmer wants to be left alone and nobody will leave him alone. It's mm-hmm. about as far as it gets. I think you're really there just for the leg blowing off and the crotch blowing up and things like that. Where was I going with that? I don't know. It doesn't compare, but the farmer, I think, has a much better shootout at the end of it than the shootout in the cat house in Rolling Thunder. I'll say that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, the don't action in this movie is really solid.
Hmm? I've not seen don't spoil Rolling Thunder. I've not seen it.
I won't.
I want to watch it again. I have it on Blu-ray, but I've only watched it once.
It's good.
It's good. It's been like 10 years since I've watched it. Has it been that long? I don't know. Maybe not that long, but it's been a minute.
Yeah, a friend of mine worked at Columbia in the mid-70s to mid-80s, and he didn't really remember this movie, coming out through Columbia. I mean, when I showed it to him, he remembered it, but...
friend Harry Fink?
The writer, Harry Fink?
Yeah.
No, he's a writer though. Gary Crutcher is his name, and he was in the story department, or the script development department at Columbia. He told me a lot of the success at the time in the mid 70s, a lot of the Jan Michael Vincent movies did really well in rural areas and small town theaters, and kind of kept Columbia alive for a couple of years there, like Baby Blue Marine, Buster and Billy, White Line Fever, a lot of those movies, and that's probably what Columbia was thinking when they picked up The Farmer. Also, having Taxi Driver, because The Farmer was shot in 75, but it wasn't released until early 77, I think February 77. So I think it was shot like in the second half of 75. Having something, after Taxi Driver, and there a lot of those movies that came out after Death Wish, especially some of the rural ones like Fighting Mad with Peter Fonda, and Breaking Point, which I think was around the same time, maybe that was 76, but the Bob Clark movie with Bo Svenson, that was around this time. I think it was 76 or 77. A lot of these revenge themed films, and especially something that would go over well in drive-ins, but apparently it did really well in Detroit, downtown Detroit.
Detroit Rock City, that is.
It's all those Stooges fans. They love stuff like this.
One of the concerns, John mentioned the Gore Gazette review of this. When this opened, it opened in New York, when they brought it back and they played it on 42nd Street and in the outer boroughs, they called it Killer Farmer, because they just thought, you release a movie called The Farmer in New York, especially
it's a strange title.
If it's second run and it's only appearing in a movie clock as a title, nobody's going to know what the hell The Farmer is or what it's about. So they call it Killer Farmer. Then it has a chance. And when it played, I think when Rick Sullivan reviewed it in 1983, he booked it himself, because it played at a theater that he was managing or that he was booking in New Jersey. And he booked it because he needed something. They had like a 2-week or 3 week guarantee on Metal Storm, and people hated Metal Storm. They hated Metal Storm so much that he needed something like really bloodthirsty to run as the second feature.
They should have
booked Killer Farmer.
They should have called Mr. Majestic Killer Melon Farmer.
They should have called the farmer Old McDonald Did Some Harm.
Old McDonald had a farm.
That should be the tagline.
Now he's out for you to buy it.
Hey, that's pretty good. I have
the
to
hard
say,
way.
Eric, that may be the tagline that Code Red just needs right now to put out and go. Now we can sell it.
Old McDonald had a farm.
Hey, speaking of that real quick, Eric, or anybody else, I got sent another disc by the Nez. It's a Bo Svenson and Thomas Millian film.
Oh my goodness. What?
I don't know what it's, I can't remember what it's called. It's upstairs, but
I'll look it up now.
Is that mid-80s? Is that like a later?
I don't know what year it's made. Hmm. It was just sent to me and I'm like, oh.
It's Il Figlio dello.
Oh, this is a terrible movie. Yeah, it's the son of the Sheik. Yeah, I forgot.
That's the one.
I forgot Bo Svenson was in that. It's a piece of shit.
Yeah.
It's an Italian comedy. You know, there's not much to say. It's
directed by Bruno Corbucci.
Yeah, no, it's a shame.
Well, I knew that you were going to be on. I saw Thomas Millian. I said, oh, I'll ask Eric because I got no idea what the hell it is.
Yeah, it's available on, last I checked, I saw it about 4 years ago. It used to be on YouTube. It's you know, it's unwatchable. It's Tomas doing his usual, put on a silly wig and makeup and stuff. And
it was one of those ones. It's one of those ones I got sent. That's Anthony gets somewhere because it's in English with Greek subtitles. So I don't know where the hell he's gotten these things from.
So if it's Son of the Sheik, is Tomas trying to be like
Rudy Valentino?
Is he trying to be like Valentino?
Yeah, it takes. If I recall correctly, it takes place in the Middle East. There's some, you know, there's stuff going that happens, and a lot of it is. I saw an English dub, but all of it falls flat. I'm sure if you understood Italian, or rather, if you understood Roman slang, then it would maybe be funny. But not for me.
We will take a break and head over to Liverpool in England and hear from Anthony and be back in a few minutes.
And now it's time for Rue Britannia with your foreign correspondent, the Nez.
This is your weekly briefing, and you're most welcome to it. In a move that surprises nobody other than wife swappers and Penge, retail chain Marks & Spencer has, as a part of the HR department's woke LGBT push, has decided to implement gender-neutral pronoun labelling and badges for its employees. This to ensure that all employees aren't misgendered. Quote unquote, why we think it's a wonderfully inclusive measure designed to avoid our staffers from being accused of being male or female, said company spokesman, Christopher or Christine Ma. We had such success last year with our wig George Floyd underwear range that we're sure that George or Georgina would embrace our new trans inclusivity effort. It's a natural extension. He, she, it, whatever, exclaimed. This whilst being undecided as regarding which particular gender bathroom to use. Men's, women's, or pubs. My advice, use a lamppost. Celebrities and lampposts, singer Rod Stewart has decided to enter the white heat of the culture war by blasting woke CRGTs for demanding he drop his regular usage of the terms darling and love. The 76-year-old skirt chaser said he had no intention of being marched to the woke public square for denunciation and cancellation by the woke Pharisee Caiaphas. Haven't been this criticised since I actually dropped Brit Eklund after the social embarrassment of the man with the golden gun in 1974, said the plastic Scot. Besides, it's more diplomatic than the other words I used to use, such as cocks and hens, dicks and minge, wangs and muff, steaks and pies, Bangers and Mash, Stags and Deers, Dog and Bitch, and my personal favourite, Alpha and Omega. This while promoting his upcoming North American tour, Blonde Female Twats in Heat. Speaking of filth, the BBC, it's been revealed, spent £9 million this year of licence fee payers' money alone chasing BBC licence fee dodgers, which in layman's terms means £3,000 per day being spent on red letters threatening legal action against the fugitives who commit the heinous social crime of watching TV without a licence. Bugs. Not least the over 75-year-olds who lost their free licence fee exemption 2 years ago. This despite the BBC employing top earners on anywhere between £1 million and £1.3 million, presenting TV shows with no viewers, radio shows with no listeners, and TV and radio shows obsessed with picking fights with the monarchy. Lest we forget the BBC is now being sued by the brother of the Princess of Wales over her interview with Martin Bashir and Panorama. The BBC's latest act of all-round left-wing spastic incontinence being a two-part BBC Radio 4 documentary on the monarchy presented by an Indian journalist who once called the royal family quote-unquote absurd. Pot calling kettle. Especially embarrassing also given how this week culture minister and porn novelist Nadine Dorries warned the Wug Broadcasting Corporation that the current licence fee of £161 per year will not be increasing in line with 5.7% inflation. Couldn't be happier. Pass the scotch. Meanwhile, also in television, all-round Saturday night TV presenters and family favourites Anton Deck have announced the publication of their first children's novel for the Christmas market, entitled The Little Driver Who Could. It's a heartwarming story of a boy who discovers a magic car, and he pursues magical adventures. One problem, though, one of the two authors has a criminal conviction for drunk driving after accidentally smashing his vehicle into an oncoming car, almost killing a mother and child. Happy Christmas from ITV. Speaking of trauma, the government has announced this week that from March next year, the NHS will now push through mandatory vaccination for all medical staffers and care workers. In short, 160,000 staffers face the possibility of summary dismissal if they effectively refuse the jab. This whilst the legacy media portrays frontline NHS employees who refuse the jab as pariahs. This also whilst the Prime Minister this week visited an NHS hospital without actually wearing a face mask. A shame nobody on his visit told him. A double jab? No thanks, Shirley. I'll stick with a double brandy. And finally, on the subject of government ministers, Northern Ireland Government Health Minister Robert Swan has decided to sue singer and all-round Misery Van Morrison over allegations Morrison called him quote-unquote dangerous over COVID-19 restrictions during the pandemic. Swan's legal team believes Morrison's repeated public statements have harmed the minister's reputation by implying he was unfit for his job during the health crisis. One problem for Swan, though, since High Court judges are thoroughly committed to free speech, and unless they're shown that their reputation has been damaged, they'll basically reject Swan's legal action once and for all. Why it would be no more libelous than accusing Boris Johnson of being... STORM!
We're back. The farmer. Time to farm some melons and stuff.
Old MacDonald did some harm.
If that tagline turns up somewhere, you know where it was invented.
Yes.
Where it was stolen from.
Well, I have to admit that that was taken from a memory of mine. When I was working with Tony Anthony back in between 2009 and 2011, Gene Quintano, who was at the time, I guess, hurting for money, Tony was telling me that he hadn't had a paying gig in years and decades. He was in the midst of developing a horror movie about a killer farmer, and the movie was called E-I-E-I-O. And he asked Jesus me like, Christ. Oh, we need a tagline. And I'm like, I don't know. Like I threw it out as a joke. Cause like the E-I-E-I-O is a terrible title for a horror movie. And I was just like, how about Old MacDonald did some harm? Just like, and he actually took me serious. It's like, my Eric, that's really good. But anyways, that project went nowhere as the world has seen.
Was this after the Jean-Claude Van Damme movie and the Sudden Death?
Sudden Death was the 90s. This is like 10 years.
Oh, okay.
I think the last, don't quote me on it, you can check. I think the last movie Gene had gotten paid prior to that was The Musketeer. And that was like 2001, maybe, okay. Right?
Yeah, it's 2001.
It's been a good decade. Mm. And he was developing that as well as developing something for Bruce Willis at the time called Grimm, G-R-I-M-M, like Grimm Fairy Tales. Mm. It was going to be another horror film shot in North Carolina. Bruce pulled out, and there went the money. I don't know what kind of relationship Gene has with Bruce, but obviously it dates back to Loaded Weapon 1. There's that very strange cameo where he's playing McClane. And Tony told me that for A Dollar for the Dead, the TNT original,
mm-hmm.
that was originally going to be theatrical with Bruce. And Bruce pulled out at the last minute to star in Last Man Standing, which ended up being a very similar movie. It's a genre shoot 'em up.
Bad movie.
Yeah, it's not good. Well, neither is Dollar for the Dead. But Bruce pulled out, and there went the financiers. And then it took about 3 or 4 years later where they got Emilio Estevez and ended up being the TNT original. So I know
Grimm is the way that Bruce Willis looks on every poster. It would have been good marketing, but this didn't happen.
My favorite part in Dollar for the Dead is when they do the sliding motorcycle gag from Hard Target or from Hard Boiled, but they do it with a horse. With a horse is sliding down the street.
Oh no.
That's a funny one. The movie's fun up until after the first half hour, it loses steam and then it's just like, whatever. But my favorite bit is the saloon one where he shoots the floorboards and then falls through the first level and shoots through the windows that somehow propels people out the window. I'm not sure why, but
you know. Stop it. You're making these films sound interesting for me to want to watch them.
No, don't. That just sounds good. Okay.
Tony was supposed to do a cameo at the beginning of the movie. There's a dead guy on a horse that has a sign around his neck or something. And Tony was supposed to play that character as a nod. But Tony threw kind of a hissy fit and didn't want to be on camera. He's very particular about being on camera, even though he looks better than pretty much all of his peers at his age. I'm not sure why that is. Mm.
Yeah, when we interviewed him, he didn't want to be on camera for the library for that podcast.
It's very strange.
Who are we talking about?
Tony Anthony.
Tony Anthony. Oh, okay.
Yeah, I did think of the stranger at the end there during the farmer when he hides under the car and shoots.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a good point. John was saying that gag might have been originated from there, and it probably was, in all honesty. But in 1967, in the first Stranger movie, I don't know if anybody remembers, but during the climax, Tony's hiding behind a mine cart for cover, and a guy goes towards him. He shoots Tony shoots him in the legs, and that kind of topples him over onto the cart, and then Tony rises up and shoots him in the back. So it's fairly similar.
Ah, yeah. I gotta pull out those Stranger movies again.
Yeah, I haven't watched them since we did the show on them. Need to go back to those. And
admire the 20-barrel shotgun that he pulls out.
Yeah.
Well, before McCabe and Mrs. Miller, he had a hero that shot people in the back.
Yeah. So did Gene Hackman in French Connection.
Yep.
Right.
Yeah, that's right.
And this is the scene where the man flees and Popeye Doyle plugs him in the back anyway, because Popeye was the type of hero we needed in the 60s.
How would
it wasn't like John Wayne.
How would Freakin' describe the car chase, Hunter?
Here we see Popeye Doyle frantically swerve to miss the woman and the child.
He didn't mention like Jimmy Breslin doing a bad take or something and him firing him or something.
What is this, Popeye Doyle here on the street?
Yeah, couldn't get Jackie Gleason for the role because I know he wanted Jackie Gleason as Popeye.
I was reading letters from Sam Berkowitz.
I did my own version of The French Connection because Owen Roisman don't know shit. I think my film looks better than his. Which it does not. The Pascal Connection. I think.
Oh, Friedkin. Yeah. This is the scene where Popeye Doyle utters a racial slur to the shock of the audience. Yet African-Americans identify deeply with this scene because they know that's what the man is thinking.
They all clapped. Blade is my best move.
Oh, man.
Can you imagine if you said The Gathering was his best movie?
Oh, The Guardian?
The Guardian.
I was like, The Gathering. Cruising. That movie will never be completed now.
Not The Gathering. No. Oh, that
this
one.
Is where the guy goes into the gay bar.
Yeah,
it's
never
going to
be finished.
Goes into the gay bar and he's got that fist up that guy's ass.
Yeah, The Gathering, that guy's never coming out of jail. So.
No.
Not after the shit he pulled.
Oh, boy. The Guardian, though. I never saw The Guardian. Is that worth seeing?
Never seen that one.
Watch it once.
I saw it once. It was.
Was it like a tree horror movie?
It was like a tree horror, yeah.
She's a wear tree.
Yeah. I'm like morbidly curious.
What was the woman's name?
Carrie Underwood.
What's the name?
No, it's. It's Carrie Lowell from License to Kill. She's the mom that's terrorized, but it's the British actress, and I can't remember her name.
Pam Boobier.
She's also married to Friedkin, so.
Is she?
That was the other one, Leslie Ann Warren. Leslie Ann Down. I get them confused, but it's the British one, I believe.
I thought it was Carrie Lowell was married to Friedkin. Or was in
No, Carrie Lowell, I think, was married to Richard Gere.
Oh, okay.
It's like we're TMZ of podcasters.
Cold padding, John.
Leslie Ann Down was in Sphinx, right? Was that?
Yeah, I believe so. I think it's the British Leslie Ann, not the one that was in the A Night in Heaven and other stuff. Yeah. I get
Victor
them all
Victoria.
Confused.
Yeah.
Right.
What does everybody think of the sappy ballad that opens the movie? Much like Rolling.
Oh, the Gene Clark tune.
Mm. Yeah.
This is one of those movies where The Farmer is one of those films where you have to have like a folk singer tell you what's going on in the film and the hearts of the characters.
No, it's not cute.
It reminded me of you guys seen the film My Name is Bruce, the Bruce Campbell one?
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, and those guys singing about the town of Goldlick.
All right, Guan.
Now they should have done like Cat Ballou. Just like every so often turn and there's Stubby K and Nat
right
and the farmer came and
like in the middle of a gory shootout
camera just whips
shoots
over.
Him in the balls and then cuts the folk singer
and the farmer garrotes you. Is it garrot or garrote? Garrot.
Depends on which coast you're on.
Does the state have the monopoly on violence? This is the question the farmer ponders as he kills extrajudicially.
And not to give anybody the wrong idea, but like he literally kills like maybe five guys at most. This is not an action extravaganza.
No, the movie's got a good like what, 20 minutes of pretty moving at a clip action.
It's not Death Wish 3. It's not like mobbing down.
No, it's
mowing down like mobs of guys.
It's a 70s action movie, which means it's a movie with action in it.
Right.
That said, something like Rolling Thunder did have like stuff sprinkled in between getting to the cat house shootout. So. But this doesn't.
What apparently drove everybody crazy at the Rolling Thunder test screenings was the scene where James Best and the gang go in and shove William Devane's hand down the garbage disposal. People got like really angry and they were like, I don't know, close to assaulting like the studio people, apparently, at the screenings, or they got up and walked out, stormed out. And it was really, really ugly. And I guess some of the executives at Fox wanted to, you know, they wanted to understand what drove them, you know, to such extremes, you know, at this audience. So they brought in like psychiatrists to watch the movie and to offer their, it's just, yeah, they came to the conclusion that it was having your home invaded and you being, you know, and witnessing the safety of, you know, the home being, you know, violated and some BS that they came up with for that. And so the Fox executives were like, okay, fine. So we'll need to cut this scene. It's like, well, why? Because the psychiatrist told you this, that this is the reason why? It's just, no, how about we don't cut it and we'll just take it to AIP. They don't care. You know, they put out, they call her One Eye, you know.
Oh, God.
They'll put it out as long as it doesn't have an X rating. And even then, they'll put out X ratings. So
don't worry, folks. Willie Devane's hand just got 3 feet longer.
Right.
Yeah, that reminds me of that Statler Brothers song, Whatever Happened to Randolph Scott, where you have to bring your analyst along to see if it's fit to see or something.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's just this distributor, he mostly did Kung Fu movies, but he for some reason bought the US or actually the worldwide rights outside of Italy for Cannibal Holocaust. This guy, Larry Joachim. And he seriously tried to get Cannibal Holocaust released in the US with an R rating. He submitted it and they're like, no, nah, this is an X. And so he went and got this psychiatrist or this child psychologist rather to come in and argue that no, really children can watch this. And it's like, no, it's an X rated movie. And this went on for like a year. They're like articles and Variety about it. It's like, no, you know, for the fifth time, it was denied. And yeah, it's just crazy. But yeah, no, he tried that. He tried to bring a child psychologist into the MPAA. No, not going to work. But you know, also getting back to the taxi driver thing, when Gary Conway shoots Timothy Scott in the head, it's almost the same framing and in the same way that De Niro kills that guy
on the sofa. Yeah, you're right.
Shot. Yeah, he's kind of like in the same way in the same position of the head and the splatter afterwards.
Just because of that groin mutilation and then the subsequent head explosion, I honestly think this probably rivals the brutality of the ending of Taxi Driver.
Yeah,
that's a good point. Close. That's a good point. Yeah, I'd say Taxi Driver is probably just a bit more vicious.
I agree, just because I think the color palette really adds to it and stuff. Although one thing that's not going to improve with a Blu-ray edition of this movie, if we're ever lucky to get it, is that crotch and head explosion, because it looks like you're watching a snuff film.
Yeah. But, you know, they had to darken Taxi Driver, right? Because that was one of the...
Right. Yeah.
It almost adds to it, though, I think. I think it made it worse. It just looks... I mean, I don't know what the original footage looks like, but it just looks sickly, all of it. Looks like you're watching something really grimy.
The blood's all dark brown or light brown. Yeah.
And, you know, getting back to, you know, what I was saying earlier about the Japanese... I'm not even going to say influence. I just think, you know, maybe subconsciously, you know, the work on that ninja script may have gone into to the farmer script. But the end of both Rolling Thunder and Taxi Driver. Well, I'm not going to say it's just Taxi Driver anyway. I've seen it. It's a lot like a Zatoichi movie. I mean, there's one specifically, I forgot which one, but where he goes in right at the end to rescue a woman from a brothel. And, you know, so there's a lot of the Yakuza influence on Schrader.
Schrader and his brother watch those all the time. So,
yeah,
sure.
Yeah. And he wrote that essay in Film Comment in 74 on Yakuza.
I had more people asking me if I had Xeroxes of that article than anything else in my archives. And really? Finally, they put it out on the web where anybody could read it. I was like, here you go. Here it is.
Yeah, it's on his website. There's a PDF of it. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, that interest spills into hardcore as well. There's not a shootout, but he ends up going to like this sex dungeon. So.
Right.
All right. Yeah. And he kind of tears down. Doesn't he to, like tear down a fake wall or something?
Yeah, he busts kind of like a bunch of walls.
Is that what he goes through the rice screens and stuff, or the paper screens, and knocks them all down and everything? It's very similar.
Right. Ouch! Hit my head.
What
was that? Oh, on the microphone.
That sounded like a sound effect, like a drop.
It was my table. Let me see if I could do it again. Nope, that was a one-time deal.
Darn.
It sounded like a. Oh, you got that wrong. Sorry, Chief.
I wish I'd talked to Gary Conway like 20 years ago or 10 years ago even. And you know, because I think, yeah, as everybody gets older, you know, you just you lose some things along the way. And you know, if I had talked to him at like age 65, I think he would have had a lot more stories, because there were some, because the attempt to do Over the Top came so close after The Farmer, and it was in the same geographical area, he kind of confused the two projects. And he was going to star in Over the Top. So in talking with him, I think there was some mix ups in what he told me. But yeah, he was with CAA in the 80s as a screenwriter. And so he worked on some projects, you know, that didn't get made. Like he wrote a script that Eddie Murphy was going to do called The Smuggler. And that was set in the Bahamas. So.
I gotta be honest, I've never heard of Gary Conway ever.
Yeah, this is my first time hearing of him. But I look at it and I go, he's been involved in a lot of projects I've heard of. I just never really noticed him.
Yeah,
I was like thinking Jeff Conaway. I was getting him mixed up. Thinking, it's the dude from Taxi, but it was not him.
First thing I'm gonna do is go watch American Ninja 2, though.
If you can, Hunter, watch Burke's Law. If you can get a hold of the VCI set of that.
Oh, okay.
Like he's the co-star, and he's like the young detective who's like the assistant to Gene Barry's character, and he's there to kind of fill in facts to move the script along. Like he's the young guy who just knows everything and helps Burke out on the case.
Yeah, mostly and a just, TV guy. Not a lot of movies.
Yeah, a lot of people like Land of the Giants?
Yeah.
I think that's the one. Yeah, a lot of people really dig that show. I've never seen it. It didn't air when I was a kid in my area. But it's on the nostalgia channels every now and then.
Okay. That's the old Sid and Marty Krofft one, is it?
No, this is
Irwin Allen.
Yeah, Irwin Allen.
Yeah.
Okay.
This is the only show. Yeah, I think it was 68 to 70.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was the only Irwin Allen show that I watched as a kid, because when I lived in Pittsburgh, it was on in reruns in the mid 70s. So, I didn't see Lost in Space until years later, and Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea. And I don't think I've ever seen The Time Tunnel, but
I've never seen it.
Tunnel's good. It's a good show.
It's good.
Yeah, I enjoy it.
I liked Land of the Giants. And we also had in Pittsburgh, we also had Wild Wild West. And I remember the episode of the Wild Wild West where he shrinks. It was you know, the Incredible Shrinking Man. It was like a knockoff of that. When I was five, it just reminded me of Land of the Giants, because it was just this the same effect. It was just giants rather than he was small.
Yeah, so it was a loveless episode, right? Yeah, it was a loveless episode.
So let's go ahead and rate this thing and wrap it up. Chris, what would you give The Farmer out of 10?
I liked it. I would give it in the present condition that the only version we're able to see, I'd say 7.
7.
Yeah.
Okay. Eric, what about you?
I dug it. It's my kind of movie, even if it's obviously a slow burn. I think it could only improve, but at the moment in the condition that it's in, 6 out of 10.
John?
I'll go 6.5, and that's totally open to raising the rating if a good print is released. And I'm sure one of the people who could do that is probably listening to this, right? You know, is listening to this show. So if it comes out, I think my rating could definitely go up if I could tell what the hell's going on in the first hour and be able to tell that his farmhand is black and other elements that I'm kind of missing out on with this current just horrid print that's on the various outlets.
And Stu.
I didn't really like it much, so I gave it a 4. I was really bored with it. And it was cheap. It was cheap looking. And to be honest, without being a bit of a Debbie Downer, I don't think there's much a HD could do for me. Me personally, to sway away from that, maybe a little, but again, it's not the sort of thing I would be buying if it came out.
Oh, come on, the testicle shooting, Stu. That would look better.
So, my initial rating is a 5, but I think it's the real reason for that is I'm watching it on a computer.
Yeah.
I'm watching a very bad print. I can tell that there is a lot of really creative stuff in the movie. The way I like the way a lot of the scenes were staged and carried out. So I do think it could go up to a 6 or a 7 for me with a nicer print. Because a lot of the genre stuff in it, I can tell that this is made by competent, creative people, and it does some interesting things. But I think a lot of my frustration with parts of it has to do with the way I'm viewing it and the quality of the print, you know, making it kind of a chore to watch.
Yeah.
I think if that was removed with a Blu-ray release, I think I would like this. I think I'd like this movie a lot more. But I think it goes to highlight the way you watch a movie can really impact your opinion of it.
I was getting a headache.
Yeah,
from looking at a computer screen that long.
I talked about the end getting really frustrated with the end because I was just like ready for it to be over. I was like, okay, he's killed the bad guy. Like, come
on. This took me back to like the 80s and 90s when I have to watch this stuff on bootleg tapes that were 6-7 generations away from the source. Or if you ordered it from Video Search of Miami, intentionally 13th generation away from the source.
Yeah.
And you got some of the Weiser family picnic at the end of the video. Yeah. If you got one of those lucky tapes.
John, would you have mowed lawns to buy this if it was available?
No way in hell. No. I would buy a Ocean Shores video that would cost $40 and look like it was 3 generations off of a 16 millimeter PAL video transfer. So there you go.
I was just super excited to see it just because, you know, how many years we'd wanted to see it. And, for all the hype that it's garnered over the years, it was never going to live. I was convinced it was going to be a real piece of shit. And so I was pleasantly surprised that we got a pretty competent vigilante movie with some pretty extreme violence towards the end.
Yeah. I wasn't disappointed at all. I was definitely digging it for most of it. We didn't really talk about the farmers off screen for a while there. Like in Act 2, it goes to Michael Dante's character.
Yeah, I thought that was an interesting way to kind of set up the eventual revenge of it. It's not, you know, it's almost like he's thrust into it unwillingly in a way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
and the whole thing with the walkie talkies and the horse races. And cause this is 1945. And I guess like it would be shortly after that, there was an Edmund O'Brien movie that had to do with that. And it was, I'm forgetting the title of it. I think it was 7-Eleven Ocean Drive, maybe was the title, but it was all about the horse races. And, rather than using walkie talkies, Edmund O'Brien sets up this, this telephone operation. And he goes from being just this average Joe who works at the telephone company, who places bets, you know, once a week when he gets paid, to becoming this kingpin of like the West Coast gambling racket. And, you know, he's killing people. And it's a really cool movie. But I thought of that when they were talking about, you know, this scam that Michael Dante's character was doing with the horse races and the walkie talkies. But yeah, I think it's called 7-Eleven Ocean Drive, and it's pretty good. It's a good Edmund O'Brien. I'm not going to say film noir because people attach that to any crime movie made.
Anything,
you know,
in black or white, right? Where they all wear suits. It's film noir, even though it clearly isn't.
Yeah, black and white in the 40s, it's noir.
Right. Yeah, this is a crime movie. So, yeah.
All right. Well, we're going to go ahead and sign out. Chris, do you have anything you want to plug before we go?
Just this book that will come out someday. Maybe sometime next year I can come back on the show again. We could talk about kung fu movies, but I co-wrote a book.
We've never done that before, ever. So that'd be good. never been mentioned ever.
So yeah, one of these days it'll be out. These Fists Break Bricks: How Kung Fu Movies Swept America and Changed the World. And it's available on audio download and just this last week audio CD, if anybody still has a CD player. But the book will hopefully be out in January, fingers crossed.
Maybe you'll get an angry email from Frank Blackman about how wrong you are about everything in the book.
Right.
Yeah. One of the problems with, you know, waiting for something to come out is you start seeing mistakes that you made, like, you know, so somebody just uploaded a trailer for Kung Fu Halloween in the last couple of weeks.
You blame me. There you go.
Anybody else got anything to plug? Eric, John, Stu?
Not this week.
All right.
Just the farmer. There we go.
All right.
The farmer.
Well, at all the usual outlets where we upload bootleg stuff.
Well, thanks for joining us, Chris.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me here.
And all right, guys, well, I'm going to go ahead and sign out. Adios.
Yes. Peace out.
Take care. Bye-bye. Good night.
Good night.
Thank you for listening to the Midnight Movie Cowboys. For more information, go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com. For feedback, comments, or show suggestions, go to midnightmoviecowboys@gmail.com. Like what you hear? Head on over to iTunes and leave us a review. Hear us on Stitcher Radio. Head over to stitcher.com and download the app. Want to help the show out? Head on over to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and hit the PayPal donate. We appreciate all donations of any denomination. Find us on Twitter at MMCowboys. Like us on Facebook. Head over to facebook.com, type in Midnight Movie Cowboys. Hit the like button over there. Want to friend us personally on Facebook or follow us on Twitter? Go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and find the links from there on the right-hand side. Thanks for listening. See you all next week.